lies anyhow. Though the words are flying fast, just don't mean a thing. In a little while I could tell you everything. But we've taken sides in anger and we can't back down. Now we're fighting just to bring the other down. And if you think to stop it now, then the next time we'll know how. I'd like to break it to you gently where we go wrong. If the rock begins rolling, we just tag along. If at first we pick the lover things that we both lack, then before we think to stop, we're into hurting back. Avalanche of answers must be found too fast. Hasty made just when we should build to last. Love what we lack, like what we share. Correction comes with time to spare. Taking sides in anger and we can't back down. Now we're fighting just to bring the other down. And if you think to stop it now, then the next time we'll know how. I'd like to tell you that it's fine, but it's not time now. I can't seem to get a word in edgewise anyhow. Though the words are flying fast, just don't mean a thing. In a little while, I could tell you everything. But we've taken sides in anger and we can't back down. Now we're fighting just to bring the other down. And if you think to stop it now, then the next time we'll know how.
That was It's Not Time Now, an insufficiently well-known song by the great John Sebastian, and it's definitely time now. So good time period, fellow sapiens, and welcome to Spider on the Web number 90. My apologies to you for how long you've had to wait for the Verschluggener thing. I hope you will be mollified a bit to hear that I've been busy writing, finally. It's still more of a trickle than a flood, but lately it's a steady trickle, and I think it's good stuff, and that'll do fine. I'm finally beginning to get this whole household maintenance operation down to a science, so that in the course of a week, I can now sometimes manage to do all the stuff that used to take two of us to get done, one of them Superwoman, and still have a little bit of time left over to stare into space and make up stuff about imaginary people. I'm not prepared to read any of it to you. I don't like to do that until I've typed the end. For all I know, tomorrow I'm going to cut everything I have so far and start over and get it right. But some of your emails lately have been hinting, "We like the music fine, Spy Boy, but how about we get a little science fiction up in here again?" So I will read you a short story of mine this time, a goofy one I'm fond of called Chronic Offender. And before and after, I have some music so good you won't believe it. So let me get right to some of it. I've made some really exciting musical discoveries since the last time we rapped, and I'll play you as many as I have time for, but I'd have to say that hands down, my favorite new discovery has been the amazing Tim Minchin. Tim comes from Australia and now lives in London. He is sort of today's Tom Lehrer, a writer and performer of really smart, really funny songs, with a great deal of what I think of as stealth warmth and humanity hidden in even his most savage satires. And I happen to know he's interested in science fiction because a recent Locus has a photo of Tim at the last Nebula banquet, which he attended as a guest of Neil Gaiman. I'm happy to say that Tim is becoming so successful that I'm sorry to say he has not yet had time to answer and may not even have seen my email request for permission to podcast some of his songs. And I can't even fall back on my usual dodge of playing you a live audience recording downloaded from dimeadozen.org without breaking his rice bowl. Because the thing is, as a singer-comedian, Tim's best thing is live performance, with an audience audibly laughing at the funny bits. So, quite sensibly, his CDs and DVDs are pretty much all recordings of live concerts, and the last thing I want to do is compete with them. Instead, I'm going to have the effrontery to offer you my own interpretation of one of my favorite Tim Minchin songs, without audience laughter to help, so please make allowances. It is funny, but it is also quite moving. A few brief remarks are necessary before I begin. First, in Tim's second verse, he makes specific reference to an Australian politician, and worse, makes specific comic reference to an aspect of his personal appearance, one he does not share with any American or Canadian politician, or indeed many humans. I felt a bit of rewrite was necessary to avoid baffling you Americans and Canadians. But I happen to rather admire the current American president, and sadly, the current Canadian prime minister is virtually satire-proof due to a total absence of any distinguishing personal, political, moral, intellectual, or physical characteristics one could successfully lampoon. So I fell back on old unreliable, my old dinner partner, George W. Bush. On reconsideration, I think I'll save my other comment until after the song. Tim describes it as a song about the feeling that you're the smallest doll in a set of babushka dolls, and as if in clairvoyant anticipation of my performance, it is titled Not Perfect. This is my planet, and I live on it. It's one-third dirt and two-thirds water, and it rotates and revolves through space at really an impressive pace, and never even messes up my hair. But here's the really weird thing, the force that keeps it spinning is the force that stops the chaos flooding in. It's my earth, and it's fine. It's where I spend the vast majority of my time. It's not perfect, but it's mine. No, it's not perfect. This is my country, and I live in it. It's very big and nice to walk on, and the guy who used to run my country built a demagoguery and taught us to be fearful and boring. Weirdest thing is that he was conservative of politics, but he turned out rather radical at spending. Well, it's my country, and it's fine. It's where I spend the vast majority of my time. It's not perfect, but it's mine. No, it's not perfect. This is my house, and I live in it. It's made of cracks and photographs. We bought it from a guy who bought it from a guy. Bought it from a guy whose granddad left it to him. And the weirdest thing is that this house has locks to keep the bad guys out, but they mostly serve to lock ourselves in. This is my house, and it's fine. It's where I spend the vast majority of my time. It's not perfect, but it's mine. No, it's not perfect, but it's mine.
This is my body, and I live in it. It's 62 and 10 months old. It's been around the block a time or two. Done stuff it wasn't built to do. I've often tried to fill it up with wine. The weirdest thing is that I've spent so much time just hating it, but it never says a bad word about me. This is my body, and it's fine. It's where I spend the vast majority of my time. It's not perfect, but it's mine. No, it's not perfect. This is my brain, and I live in it. It's made of love and bad song lyrics. I keep it tucked behind my eyes, where all my fucked up thoughts can hide. 'Cause God forbid I hurt somebody. The weirdest thing about a mind is that each new answer that you find is the basis of a brand new cliche. This is my brain, and it's fine. It's where I spend the vast majority of my time. It's not perfect, but it's mine. No, it's not perfect. Not sure I've worked out how to work it. No, it's not perfect, but it's mine. I
have a tiny footnote that I hope won't hurt Tim's feelings. A fellow named Phil Doust could explain why. It's just a tiny technical scientific error, but I find it interesting enough to mention. In the first verse of Not Perfect, Tim says that Earth is one-third dirt and two-thirds water. The first 20 times I heard that, I nodded, but on the 21st, it suddenly occurred to me that it's not true at all. Oh, of course it's true. We've all heard it all our lives, but it's only true if you're talking about surface area. Paint a globe accurately, and you'll need twice as much blue paint as any other color, sure. But that's just the surface. So I got curious and Googled up, and in fact, Terra is more than 99% dirt, some of it molten to be sure, and less than 1% water. When I mentioned this in an email to my friend John Varley, Herb told me that if you were to shrink the planet down to the size of a beach ball and you picked it up, it wouldn't even feel damp to your fingers. But there's no way to repair the lyric except to clumsy it up by inserting a lead-in phrase, and the shortest one I can think of, a globe that's, is still too long. So I say to hell with it, forget I mentioned it, Tim, nobody but some pedantic, literal-minded, science fiction-writing Canadian bozo would even notice, let alone bring it up. All right, I'm going to let that song hang in the air a while, before I start bringing in the real professional musicians to smoke my ass. So perhaps I should get right to the part of this podcast that always makes people reach for their Kleenex, the sinus friction. This story was first published in 1984, and if you're not old enough to remember, the economy had just gone straight into the toilet, and everybody was talking about another Great Depression. So you see, nothing ever really changes, for anywhere near long enough, does it? Anyway, I wrote this story as a tribute to and in my best imitation of the style of one of my very favorite writers. It can be found in my Bain Books paperback collection by any other name, and it is called Chronic Offender. In respectful memory of Damon Runyon, who knows no other tense than the present, and sometimes the future.
You would think that when a guy sees 80 summers on Broadway, he sees it all. And until recently, so will I. It is a long time since I see something that surprises me very much, and in fact, the last time I remember being surprised is when the Giants take the win for L.A. But when I come home a couple of nights after my 80th birthday, along about 4 bells in the morning, and find a ghost watching my TV, I am surprised no little, and in fact, more than somewhat. At first, I do not figure him for a ghost. What I figure him for is a hophead, what they call nowadays a junkie, and most guys will figure this proposition for a cinch at that. I decide that my play is to go out again and have a cup of coffee and come back when he is finished and maybe even ask the gendarmes to come back before he is finished. But Esther will never hoof again, and neither will I, because I have not even managed to get her into reverse, when this character hauls out a short John Roscoe and says like this, "Stand and deliver." This is when I figure him for a ghost, because I recognize the words he uses, and then his voice, and finally his face. And who is it but Harry the Horse? Now, Harry the Horse is never a guy I am apt to hang around with, as he is a very tough guy who will shoot you as soon as look at you, and maybe even sooner. Furthermore, he is many years dead at this time, and I figure the chances are good that the climate where he is lately is hot enough to make him irritable. In fact, I am wishing more with every passing moment to go have this cup of coffee, but I cannot see any price at all on arguing with a John Roscoe, especially such a John Roscoe as is being piloted by Harry the Horse, or even his ghost. So I up with my mitts and say as follows, "Don't shoot, Harry!" Well, it turns out that nobody is more surprised than Harry the Horse when he recognizes me. I cannot figure this, since I always understand that ghosts know who they are haunting, but then again, I never hear of a ghost packing a John Roscoe at that. In fact, I start to wonder if maybe Harry the Horse is not a hallucination, and I am gone daffy. You have to understand that Harry the Horse looks not a day older than when I see him last, which is going back about 50 years. Furthermore, his suit is the kind they do not make for 50 years, except it looks no older than is customary on Harry when I know him. And likewise, his hair is greased up like only some of the spicks and smokes they'll do anymore. And in fact, he looks in every respect like he does when I last see him, except that he is not smiling and not laying down and does not seem to have several 45 caliber holes in him. In fact, he looks pretty good, except for his forehead being wrinkled up a little like something is on his mind. "Well," he says, "it is certainly good to see you, even if you do become an ugly old geezer. I will never think to guzzle your joint if I know it is you. In fact, I will not guzzle your joint, even though this causes me some small inconvenience, because," he says, "you have always been aces with me. So now you must help me pick some other joint to guzzle." Now, I hear of ghosts that like to scare a guy out of his pants, although personally I never meet one, but I never hear that they are interested in the contents of the pants pockets, even if they are the ghost of Harry the Horse. "Harry," I say, "what would a guy such as yourself be doing work in the second story?" "Well," Harry the Horse says, "that is a long story. But if I do not tell the story to someone soon, I think I will go crazy, and in fact you are just the guy to tell it to, because you remember the way things used to be in 1930.
"Harry," I say, "I have nothing better to do than hear your story."
And Harry the Horse nods and says to me like this, "One day, me and Spanish John and little Isidore all happened to be in a sneezer together on account of a small misunderstanding about the color of some money we are spending, and I wish to say in passing that this beef is a total crock, as we steal that money fair and square from a bank on Tite Avenue, and can we help it if things are so bad that banks are starting to pass off funny money? But anyway, there we are in the sneezer, so naturally we called Judge Goldfarber to get us out. As you probably know, Judge Goldfarber is by no means a judge and never is a judge, and in my line it is 100-1 against him ever being a judge, but he is a lawyer by trade, and he is better than Houdini at getting citizens out of the sneezer, and in fact when it comes to getting out of the sneezer, Goldfarber is usually cheaper than buying a real judge at that. So we call him, and he comes right down and springs us, and then he takes us back up down to his office and pours us a couple of shots of scotch, and furthermore, it is scotch he gets from Dave the Dude. And you know that Dave the Dude handles only the very best merchandise. So we knock him back, and then Goldfarber says like this, "Boys, when I spring a guy for bad paper, it is my firm policy never to accept my fee in cash. None of you has any gold or securities, so I propose to take it out in trade." "Judge," I say, You have always been a good employer, and in fact it seems to me that every time you put a little job our way, we come away with a few bobs for our trouble. Furthermore, you are a right G, because you put down several potatoes to bail us out, and you must know that you have no more chance of seeing us show up in court than Hoover has of ever seeing another vote, so we are happy to entertain your proposition. Well, he says, it is not exactly a job you can be proud of.
How do you mean? Little Isidore asks.
Well, for one thing, it involves chilling a guy, and an old guy besides, and furthermore, he is one of those guys who is so brilliant he is like a baby. It's not exactly sporting.
Judge, Spanish John says to him, I and my friends are suffering gravely from the unemployment situation, because nobody is working and making money. There's nobody for us to rob. And if there's nobody for us to rob, we are reduced to robbing banks, and you see how that works out. I do not speak for my friends, but I myself would be happy to chill somebody just on general principles. And if it is an old guy that does not shoot back, why, so much the better.
It involves work, Judge Goldfarber says.
How do you mean work?
Physical exertion, manual labor. You will have to carry something very much like a phone booth, and which weighs maybe twice as much as a phone booth, down 3 flights of stairs and deliver it to my place out on the island.
Judge, I say, greatly horrified, we are eternally grateful for what you do for us, but to do manual labor in satisfaction of a debt is perilously close to honest work, and that is more grateful than I, for one, wish to be. However, I say, as he starts to frown, not only am I grateful, but I just remember that you know where Isidore and me buried Boat Race Benny 3 years ago, so we will accept your job. So he gives us an address up in Harlem, and that night we borrow a truck somebody is not using to go up there. The job goes down as easy as a doll's drawers, or maybe even easier. The building is a big fancy joint with a doorman and everything, but the lock on the back door does not give little Isidore any difficulty, and neither does the lock on the apartment door of the old geezer. The name on his door is Dr. Filbert Twitchell, so we figure him for a sawbones, except it turns out he is not that kind of doctor, but the professor kind. Anyway, we stick him up in his bed, and we scare him so bad we nearly save ourselves the trouble of croaking him. We tell him to show us the phone booth and Toots Wheat, and he just blinks at us. This Doc Twitchell is about 1 million years old and bald as an 8-ball, and I wish to say I never see another guy like him for blinking. In fact, I remember thinking that he will be a handy guy to have around on a hot day, since he keeps a pretty good breeze going, except, of course, by that time the hot day comes around, he will not be blinking so good and is apt to smell bad besides. About the time I haul the hammer back on my Roscoe, he gives up blinking and gets up and puts on a bathrobe that looks like it belongs to Jack Johnson, and he takes us to the phone booth. It is in a big room way in back of his apartment, and a room is a kind of a lavatory, like in this movie I see when I am 10 years old called Frankenstein, which I hear they are going to remake as a talkie. Anyway, there is all kinds of machines and gadgets and gizmos and a wire the size of a shotgun barrel taped along the floor from the wall to the bottom of his phone booth. It is the size and shape of a phone booth, but it does not really look much like one, and in fact it makes me think of a stand-up coffin, except for all the wires and things hanging off of it. There is no door in it, so I can see the thing is empty, and it occurs to me that it will make a fair coffin at that, since we can carry the doc downstairs in it and save an extra trip. Okay, I say, this is a cinch. Spanish John, you go down and get the dolly out of the back of the truck. Little Isidore, you go along and wait for him at the door. Keep lookout whilst I croak the doc here. At this, the doc starts in blinking 1 mile a minute. He starts to say something, and then he thinks better of it, and waits until Spanish John and Little Isidore are gone, and then he starts talking even faster than he is blinking, which is pretty fast talking indeed. He talks kind of tony, with lots of big fancy words, but I give you the gist.
Goldfarber, the mouthpiece, sends you guys to see me, am I right?
I admit this, and start putting a silencer on my John Roscoe.
Would you consider double-crossing Goldfarber?
Certainly. What is your proposition?
You mean Goldfarber does not tell you?
He says, very surprised. Tell me what?
This thing you call a phone booth is a time machine.
What do you mean, like a big clock? Where is the hands?
No, no, he says, real excited. A machine for traveling in time.
In time for what?
No, through time. My machine can take you into next week, or next year, or the year after that. It is the only one in the world.
Well, I never hear of such a machine at that.
Of course not, he says. You and me and that thief Goldfarber are the only 3 people in the world that know about it.
Okay, I tell him. So get to the part about why I should double-cross Goldfarber.
Don't you see,
he says, blinking away.
You could travel to tomorrow night, read the stock market quotations, and then come back to today and buy everything that is going to go up.
I do not know too many guys in the stocks racket, I tell him, and furthermore, I hear it is a chancy proposition. But if I understand you, I can go to tomorrow night and read the racing results and then come back and bet on all the winning ponies? I'm commencing to get excited.
Exactly, he says, jumping up and down a little. Likewise, the World Series and the football and the elections, and the sky is the limit.
By now I am figuring the angles, and I am more excited than somewhat. This is a machine such as a guy could get very rich with, and I am a guy such as likes the idea of being very rich. Does it work backwards? Can I go back to yesterday or last week?
Hell no, he says,
or anyway, that is what the things he says come down to.
Oh, it can be done, he says, but I never have the guts to do it, and in fact only a dope will try it. Why,
his voice gets real quiet and solemn like a funeral.
Why, you might make a pair of ducks.
I can make no sense of this, but he says it like it is something to be very, very afraid of, and I figure he ought to know. But I decide it does not matter, because I figure going to tomorrow is plenty good enough for me. I point my Roscoe at the dock. Prove to me that this machine does like you say.
Give me a watch,
he says, and I do so.
See, he says, it is just now exactly 5 minutes to midnight. Am I right?
I look at the watch, and he is perfectly right. He puts the watch on the floor of the phone booth.
How long do you figure it is before your associate comes back with the dolly?
Well, I tell him, figuring he has a pint in his pants pocket, and he knows we are in no special hurry, maybe it takes him another 5 minutes.
Okay, he says, so I set the machine for 2 minutes.
He fiddles with some dials and things on the outside of the phone booth and pushes a button. The light goes way down, like when a guy gets it at Sing Sing, and even before it comes back up, I see that the phone booth isn't there anymore. The big wire ends in a plug. The socket for it is gone. It scares me so much I almost scragged the dock by accident, and now that I think of it, it is a better thing all the way around if I do it that. But the slug misses him clean. Since I have the silencer on, it is 6-1 that little Isidore never even hears the shot. Then I just watch the dock blink for 2 minutes, and finally, the phone booth is back again. My watch is still in it, and the watch is still ticking, but it says that it is still 5 minutes at midnight. The machine works. Say, I tell the doc, this is okay. Can you set this thing to go and then come right back again?
Certainly, he says. Watch.
He fiddles with it again, and this time when he pushes the button, the light in the phone booth just kind of flicker like a movie.
See, he says, just goes into tomorrow, stays there an hour, and then comes right back to the instant it leaves.
My head hurts when I try to think about this. Okay, I say, here is what you do. You set that thing to take me into the future. I want to see what the world looks like when the Depression is over, so you better send me a long way. Say, 50 years. They ought to have the country back on its feet by then. Have the phone booth go to 1980, stay there for a whole day, and then come right back to here. You can do this?
It's a cinch, he says, blinking up a storm, and he does like I say. There, just push that button and off she goes.
Can I make it work from inside?
Certainly, he says, and shows me another button on the inside. I am planning to experiment with people, he says, instead of just objects and wop pigs when you boys guzzle my joint. In fact, I will do it already, except I decide I should patent the phone booth first, and I bring the idea to that gun of Goldfaber, which I now regret.
Actually, he does not call it a phone booth any more than he uses any of the regular words I am putting in his mouth. What he calls it is, give me a minute, a chronic lodge misplacer, I think he says. What happens to the wop pigs, I ask him, beginning to get a little nervous.
Not a thing, he says. They come back perfectly copacetic and into pink, and in fact, there they are now.
And he points, and sure enough, over in the corner is a bunch of cages full of little wop pigs, and I am relieved to see that they look happy, and there are no empty cages.
Well, he says, what do you say?
I make you rich, and you do not make me dead. You cannot get a better deal than that. Sure I can, I say, and his eyelids commence to flutter so fast I can feel the breeze a clear 6 feet away. The right eye seems to blink faster than the left, so that is the eye I shoot him in. Then I go out and scrag little Isidore, and I meet Spanish John on the landing where he is communing with his pint and scrag him too, and then I put him on the dolly and carry him upstairs and stretch him out next to little Isidore. It makes me no little sad to see them lying there, because they are my friends a long time. But I cannot help but think how fortunate it is that it is me Doc Twitchell tells his secret to, because otherwise I will be laying there stiff, and one of my friends will be standing around feeling sad, and I do not wish a friend of mine to have this sorrow. Then I go back to the phone booth. I figured a deal for a cinch. I will go to 1980, and I will go to the public library. They got books in there that are records of all the pony races ever run, and naturally I know where they keep these books, since I often have recourse to them in the course of business.
I will burgle the joint and heist such books as are related to races from 1930 to 1980, which certainly cannot take me more than a day, and then I will come back to 1930 and find out what it is like to be a millionaire. So I step into the phone booth and push the button. All of a sudden, it is very dark, and the lights do not come back up, so I figure I maybe blow a fuse or some such. I step out of the phone booth and light a match, and I almost drop it. The whole room is completely different. Mostly what it is empty. The doc's body is gone, and so are all the gizmos and gadgets and so on, and even the cages full of little wop pigs. The match goes out, and I think about it, and... Well, now I think about it, of course it figures that a joint does not look the same after 50 years, and especially not if you croak the guy who owns it. It does not seem like anybody owns this joint for a long time, and I figure that for a piece of luck, all things considered. Until I light the second match and notice the other thing that is missing. The big wire. Well, hell, I say to myself, of course it will not still be around after 50 years. So while I am out guzzling the track records, I will guzzle a bunch of big wire from a wire place and a plug as well. Except the light switch does not work when I try it, and it looks like there is no electric in the apartment now, because I keep finding little homemade candles in all the rooms all burned down. There is nothing else in the joint but junk, and there is no water in the crapper or the faucets, and I commence to get the idea that this building is abandoned. So now I must get the electric turned back on, as well as heist the track records and the wire. Except I do not see how I will get the electric turned on, as I do not happen to be holding any potatoes at the moment, and in fact what I am is broke. To heist potatoes and track records and wire and get the electric turned on all in one day is a pretty full day even for a tough guy such as myself. But if this is what I must do to be the richest guy in the world, then I will take a crack at it. So I leave, and you know what? Harlem is all full of smokes these days. Oh, you hear about this? Yeah, I guess you will at that. Anyways, not only is Harlem all over smokes, but these are very hostile smokes such as I never see before. I run into one on the landing, and I show him the equalizer to clear him out of my way, and what does he do but say something about my ma and then haul out an equalizer of his own? It is only good fortune that I escaped the shame of being croaked by a smoke, and this shakes me up no little. I pass some other smokes in the street outside, and they all act unfriendly, too. One of them tries to tell me I am a hunky, which I cannot figure until I see he wears black cheaters and probably is blind. Except he is by no means blind, because he outs with a shiv as long as my foot and tries to put a couple new vents in my suit, and I am forced to break his face. This brings a whole bunch of smokes, all hollering and carrying on in smoke and some in spick, and I decide I will leave Harlem for the time being. I run pretty good and build up a good lead, but then I blow it when I decide to steal a heap. I get it high-wired, okay, but the shift is all funny, and I can't find the clutch any place. So I leave the heap just before these 10 dozen yelling smokes catch up, and a few blocks later I find a taxi waiting at a red light and jump in. The jockey starts to give me a hard time, but I show him the Roscoe and tell him to take me where the white people live and toots wheat, so he shuts up and drives without putting on the meter even. I try to see how he drives with no clutch, but I cannot see his feet, and besides, he never seems to use the shift at all. While he drives to short, I look around. Harlem does not seem to be a class neighborhood anymore. Naturally, what with all the smokes living in it? And in fact, it is nothing but a dump. Doc Twitchell's building is by no means the only one abandoned, but when we get downtown, I see that things are not much better there. Oh, there are some awful fancy big new buildings here and there, but there are also a great many buildings just as broken down as the ones up in Harlem. I see many more winos and rum-dums and hopheads on the street than I remember, and furthermore, there is garbage all over the place in big piles. So I tell the jockey to pull up and buy a paper, and what do you know? I do not go far enough forward in time, because it seems the depression is still going on, and nobody is looking to see it get any better. I cannot figure this, because I asked the jockey, and he tells me the president after Hoover is a Democrat, and furthermore, who is it but the governor of New York, Frankie Roosevelt? So I guess you never know. It just keeps getting worse. I have the jockey take me to the library, only the library is not where I left it, and in fact it is a whole new building altogether. I can see that even if I get into this joint, I cannot find where they now keep the track records in the dark, and I have no flashlight, so there is nothing for it but a daylight heist in the morning. And it figures I cannot get the electric turned on or the wire until sunup either. So I figure all I can do now is scare up some potatoes for operating expenses. Only I decide to scare up a drink first because I am all of a sudden very, very toasty. So I take the jockey's potatoes and tell him to take me to Lindy's. Only he never hears of Lindy's.
or of Good Time Charlie's, or the Bohemian Club, or any other deadfall I name, not even the Stork Club. So I tell him I wish a drink. And he hauls off and brings me to this place all full of bright lights and guys wearing dolls' clothes, and where they wish two bobs for a drink of scotch, which is nothing but a shot. In fact, it is in my mind to shoot the jockey for this, except for some reason he is gone when I come out, even though I tell him to wait. Well, I walk a couple of blocks, figuring to guzzle a few pedestrians, but my luck is terrible, as half of them are broke and the other half shoot back, and one of them actually has the brass to pick my pocket while I am shaking him down and take the rest of the jockey's potatoes, so now I am broke again. It goes like that all night. I can tell you all manner of stories, like what happens when I go over to Central Park to get a little shut-eye, and what a dump Times Square turns into, but you probably hear this already, and besides, I see that you are tired, so I will make a long story short. So when the library opens up the next day, I go in and ask this old doll about the track records, and she says they do not have these books anymore. She says they have the information I wish, but it is not in books anymore. I know this will sound nutty, but I make her say it twice, very slow. She says the information is on her crow film. So I ask her to give me some of her crow film, and she does. And what is it but a tiny little thing like a roll of caps, or maybe like a little reel for a movie that is 2 minutes long? And for all I know, nowadays crows do watch such films in this town. She puts it in a machine, and it makes words on a screen, like a newsreel, only it does not move unless you make it. I have her get the crow film with the right horse records on it, and I watch how she works it until I figure I can do it myself. So now I must steal not only the drawer full of crow film, but the machine to read it, and I am not sure it will fit in the phone booth with me. But I figure I will cross that bridge when I get to Brooklyn, and I thank the old doll and watch where she puts the drawer full of crow film back, and I go try to price the wire I need. You will not think there can be more than one kind of wire as big around as a shotgun barrel, but it turns out there are several dozen such kinds, and I do not know which kind I want. But I figure I will come back that night after closing and borrow a dozen kinds and try them all. Then I shake down a necktie salesman for some change and call the electrics, and they tell me that to turn on the electric in that building for even one night, they have to have a security deposit of no less than 200 potatoes. This 2 yards must be in cash, and furthermore, there are fire inspectors to be greased and so forth, and it will take at least a week. By this time, I am commencing to get somewhat discouraged, and in fact, I am downright unhappy. That night, I go back up to Harlem with some trivial difficulty, and I sit in that phone booth from 11:30 to 12:30, just in case it will still go home without the electric, and it does not. I figure the doc slips it to me pretty good, and in fact, it is a dirty shame I cannot croak him twice, or even three times. So I figure I am stuck here, and am not apt to become a rich guy after all, and in fact, it is time to do a little second-story work and build up my poke. So I bust your joint, and I wish to know how come, if the Depression is still around, movies get so cheap that you can show talkies in your own joint, with colors yet, and furthermore, you can leave them running while you take the air. Also, where is the projector? When Harry the Horse finishes telling me this story, and I finish telling him about television, I get out the old nose paint, and we have a few, and in fact, we have more than a few, although Harry the Horse says he once makes better booze in a trash can, and as a matter of fact, I know this to be true. A little while after the bottle is empty, an idea comes to me, and I say to Harry the Horse like this. Harry, you are welcome to stay at my joint as long as you wish, naturally, because you are always aces with me. But if you still wish to go back to 1930 and become a rich guy, I think I can fix it.
It is too late, he says. The doc sets the phone booth to go home after 24 hours, and it does not, so I am stuck here, even if I get the electric and the wire and the crow film machine, which I figure is about a 20-to-1 shot.
Harry, I tell him, you will naturally not know this, but nowadays almost all the clocks in this man's town are on electric, and if you pull out the plug, the clock stops. So I figure if we plug the phone booth back in, 24 hours after that, it goes home with you inside, and maybe also this crow film machine. Harry thinks this over and starts to cheer up.
This appeals to me no little, he says, with or without the crow film machine. I like 1930 better.
I decide maybe Harry the Horse is not so dumb at that.
But can you fix the rest, he asks.
I think I can. So I call up my friend Toomey, the electrician, who everybody calls Socket.
He is a little agitated at being woke up at 5 bells in the morning, but I tell him there's a couple of guys here that wish to sell a dozen lids of Hawaiian pot for 30 bobs a lid, and he says, on my way, and hangs up.
Harry the Horse wishes to translate it. Well, I explain, Prohibition is over since a little after I see you last.
Harry is greatly surprised to hear this.
What do the coppers do for a living?
Well, there is this pot, which is nothing but muggles, only it is now as illegal as booze used to be. And right now in this man's town, there are maybe 6 million citizens as are apt to pay 60 or 100 bobs for an ounce of this muggles, and 30 is a very good price.
Harry the horse shakes his head at this, and just then the bell rings, and it is none other than Socket, all out of breath.
He is a young guy, but a very good electrician, and in fact he wires my joint for me when I get the air conditioned. And for a young guy, he knows the way things are. He is very aggravated when he finds out there is no Hawaiian muggles, and in fact he turns and starts to leave. But when he puts his hand out to the doorknob, he finds a shiv pinning his sleeve to the door so he cannot reach the knob, and when he looks around, he sees Harry the horse deciding where to put the next one. So Socket decides he does not wish to reach the knob after all, and says as much. So we explain the story to Socket, which uses up my last bottle of sauce, and he says he is willing to look the proposition over. When we hit the street, I wonder how we are going to get up to Harlem, because I am not anxious to take the subway. But right off, we find a hack who is so thoughtless as to park where he cannot make a quick getaway. So when Harry the horse sticks his John Roscoe in the window of the short, there is nothing the jockey can do except get out and give us his short. A few blocks away, we change plates, and then we pick up Socket's tools and electric stuff from his joint and head up Broadway at a hell of a clip, and we end in Harlem in no time or maybe less. We get into the building with no trouble, and Socket even manages to cop a lid of Mexican muggles from a little skinny smoke we find in the lobby before we chase the smoke out. Socket puffs up on this muggles while he checks out the electric room in the basement, and he likes what he sees in the electric room.
I can power this building for a few days, he tells us.
Alarms will go off downtown, and sooner or later an inspector comes to see what the hell. But with the red tape and all, it has to be a good 2 or 3 days before he gets here. He goes ahead and does this, and then he takes a light bulb out of his pouch and puts it in the wall, and now it works. He puts away his flashlight and pokes around the basement, and what does he find but a real old hunk of wire as big around as a shotgun barrel, and in every respect such as Harry the horse describes it, except for the cobwebs. In fact, Socket says he figures it is the original wire, which is tossed down in the basement and forgotten by whoever rents Doc Twitchell's apartment after he croaks. This is water on the wheel of Harry the Horse, who now begins to think maybe his luck is back with him, and to like Socket besides. Harry is very anxious for this to work, because a few minutes before he is obliged to plug a rat the size of a Doberman, and Harry the Horse is thoroughly disgusted with 1980 for letting rats into a class neighborhood like Harlem, smokes or no smokes. So we go up to the third floor, and there is the phone booth, just like Harry the Horse describes it, except there is a hophead sleeping in it. We chase the hophead out, and Socket sets the wire back up the way it is supposed to be and plugs it in. Right away the phone booth starts to hum, and Harry the Horse gets a great big smile on his pan. Socket puts a light bulb in the ceiling and turns it on, and then he looks the phone booth over.
I cannot figure much of this, he says, but this part here has to be the delay timer.
If you want to go back right now, you just twist this back to zero.
Not yet, Harry the Horse says. It is nice to know I do not have to wait 24 hours, but I am not yet ready. I must go guzzle the crow film and the machine.
All of a sudden, Harry the Horse frowns like he sees a fly in the ointment. I begin to see the same fly, too, and so does Socket, because he speaks up and says like this.
Harry, I know what you're thinking. You do not wish to leave us here while you go rob my crow film.
What do you mean, your crow film? Harry asks angrily. It is my crow film.
Of course, Socket says real quick. The point is, you are afraid if you leave us behind with a machine, it may not be here when you get back, or us either for that matter, and I am honest enough to admit that this is at least a 10-to-1 shot. If you are as honest, you will admit that what you think you will do about this is scrag us both. Is that so?
I like your style, kid, Harry the Horse says to him, but I will admit that this seems like the good thing to do.
I thank you for your honesty, Socket says. You will understand that I am altogether opposed to this proposition on general principles. So here is my thought. How about if I come with you while you swipe the crow film machine and generally be of assistance, for it is sure to be heavy, and meanwhile our mutual friend here, meaning me, will keep watch over the phone booth and keep the junkies out of it. He is not apt to take the lamb with it on account of he is an old geezer who cannot cut it in 1930 without a joint or a job, and besides, if he does, you will surely scrag me, and I am his friend.
This sounds Jake to me, Harry the Horse decides.
So off they go together, hurrying a bit because it is a little past 6 bells in the morning and the sun will be up soon.
They come back in about an hour with a drawer full of crow film and the machine for it, and while Harry the horse checks to make sure the machine fits in the phone booth, Socket looks over the phone booth some more. "I think I begin to figure this out," he says. "Frankly," Harry the horse says, "and I hope you will not be offended, I am not so sure. You say if I twist this little dingus right here, I go right back where I start, right?"
"Right to the moment you leave," Socket agrees.
"I am reluctant," Harry the horse says, "to tamper with the way Doc Twitchell leaves the machine and then test the result with my personal body. It is more than half a day until the phone booth is supposed to go back. Suppose I get there half a day early."
"That is impossible," Socket tells him. "That would be a pair of ducks."
Harry the horse frowns. "That is exactly what I mean. I wish to have no truck whatsoever with these ducks, as Doc Twitchell tells me they are bad medicine." By this time, I am tired of hanging around in Harlem with Harry the horse, and I do not care a fig if he does get a pair of ducks, or even a pair of goats or chickens. "Harry," I say, "my good friend Socket knows all about this science jazz. He reads all the rocket ship stuff, and you can rely on him. It is a piece of cake." Maybe I say it too enthusiastic, because Harry frowns even more. "If it is so safe," he says to me, "why do you not be the one who tries it out? In fact," he says, "I think this is a terrific idea." Now, this horrifies me no little, and in fact more than somewhat. But I am not about to let on to Harry the horse that I am terrified, or he is apt to figure I care more about myself than him and become insulted. So I swallow and head for the phone booth. "As soon as you get there and see that everything is copacetic," Harry tells me, "you push the button again. It is still set the same way, so it should bring you right back here. Do not monkey with it."
"Wait," Socket yells, and this seems like a terrific idea to me. "Listen, Harry," he says, "I figure this gizmo will take him back to the very instant he leaves, or maybe a split second after. But if he then pushes the button again right away, it brings him forward the same amount of time as before, and he arrives a second after you do, a day and a half ago. Except there is already a phone booth here, and nowhere for his to go, so there's a big explosion."
My blood pressure now goes up into the paint cards. Harry thinks about this, and I can see it as a strain for him. "So how do we do this?"
"Well," Socket says, "I think I get the hang of this phone booth, and if I am right, this dial here is for years, and this one is for days, and this one is hours, and so on. See, the years one is on 50, and the rest are in neutral."
"So?" "So all he has to do when he gets back to 1930 is move the days dial forward one notch, and the hours dial ahead 7 notches, and the minutes say 30 to be on the safe side, and he arrives here about 15 minutes from now." Harry the horse looks at me. "You get that?" he says.
"Yeah," I tell him, a little distracted, because something just occurs to me.
"Listen," Socket says to me, "for the love of Pete, do not fail to set the delay timer again before you push the button to come back here. Anything over 5 minutes is probably fine. Otherwise, as soon as you get here, you slingshot right back to 1930 again."
"Gotcha," I say, and he turns the delay gizmo back to zero. All of a sudden, the lights get dim like a brownout, and when they come back up again, Harry the horse and Socket are nowhere to be seen. What is to be seen is a lot of gadgets and gizmos and little wop pigs and an old dead guy I know as Doc Twitchell. "I will be damned," I say to myself. "It works." Perhaps I should do like I promised Harry the horse and go right back. If I do not arrive back at the right time, he is apt to get angry and scrag my young friend Socket. But I figure I can reset the dials to any time I want, and if it does not work out right, it is Socket's fault for giving me the bum steer. And besides, I cannot help myself. I go into the living room and get some subway tokens and a couple of bobs from little Isidore's pants pocket. And I take the A train down to Broadway. Broadway is just beginning to jump when I get there. On account of it, it's just past midnight, and I wish to tell you it looks swell. The guys and dolls are all out taking the air, and I see faces I do not see for a long, long time. I see Lance McGowan and Dream Street Rose and Bookie Bob and Miss Missouri Martin and Dave the Dude with Miss Billy Perry on his arm and Regret the Horse Player and Nicely Nicely Jones and the Lemon Drop Kid and Waldo Winchester the Newspaper Scribe and all kinds of people. I see Joe the Joker give Frankie Ferocious a hot foot while Frankie is taking a shine from a little smoke. I see Rusty Charlie punch a draft horse square in the kisser and stretch it in the street. I buy an apple from Madame Le Gimp. I find the current location of Nathan Detroit's permanent floating crap game and lose a few bobs. I stick my noodle into Lindy's, and I watch a couple dolls take it off at the Stork Club the way dolls used to take it off, and I even have a drink at Good Time Charlie's, even though Good Time Charlie naturally does not recognize me and serves me the same liquor he serves his customers. You know something? It is the best booze I taste in 50 years. I see people and places and things that I say goodbye to a long time ago, and it feels so good that after a while I haul off and bust out crying. Somehow I never seem to bump into myself, my 30-year-old self, while I am walking around, and I guess this is just as well at that. After a while, I decide that I am awake a long time for a guy my age, so I walk over to Central Park and take a snooze near the pond. When I wake up, it is just coming on daylight, and I am hungry, and there is very little of Little Isidore's dough left, so I take the A train back up to Harlem and sneak in the back door of Doc Twitchell's building again. When I get back to the phone booth, it is just about 7:30 bells, so I set the dial ahead one day and no hours and no minutes, and then I set the delay thing, and I push the button. The lights go down and up, and there are Harry the Horse and Socket again. Socket looks very glad to see me, and for that matter, so does Harry the Horse. "It worked great," I tell him, and step out. "This is good news," Harry says, "because I am commencing to get impatient. Socket, I am sorry I do not trust you. Both of you are right G's, and you both assist me more than somewhat, and I tell you what I will do. When I get back home and become a rich guy, I will put half of the first million I make into a suitcase, and I will bring the suitcase to the First National Bank downtown and tell them to surrender it to you guys in 50 years, and you can go right down there today and get it. How's that for gratitude?" Socket's face gets all twisted up funny for a minute, like he wants to say something and does not want to say it all at the same time. "Harry," I say, "do you ever come back yourself?" "Nah," he says. "This stuff gives me the willies. And 1980 you can keep. As soon as I get back home, I shoot up this phone booth until it does not work anymore. I have all I need to be a rich guy, and if anybody else gets a hold of the phone booth, maybe it gets around and they start not having horse races anymore or something. So this is goodbye." He puts the crow film machine and the drawer full of crow films in the booth and steps in with them. "Well, Harry," I say, "I wish to thank you for your generosity. 500,000 bobs is pretty good wages for an electric guy and a dago pig. Enjoy your riches and goodbye." He has Socket move the delay gizmo back to zero, and the lights go down and up again, and that is the last I ever see of Harry the Horse, any way you look at it. "Socket," I start to say, "I hope you do not think for a minute that there is any 500,000 clams waiting at the bank for us." "Well, I know there's not," he says, and he shows me a little teeny light bulb the size of a peanut. "I do not like the way this mug talks about plugging people such as yourself and me. So while he and I are guzzling the crowfill machine, I decide it will be a great gag if I take this bulb out when he is not looking, and sure enough he never knows any different. I regret this later when he speaks of 1,000,000 iron men, but I cannot think of a tactful way to bring the matter up, and he still has the gat, so I let it ride. Without this bulb," he says, "Harry the Horse cannot read the crow film, and they do not make this bulb 50 years ago." Well, at this, I am so surprised that I never get around to telling Socket to me why it is that I am so certain there are no 500,000 potatoes waiting for us at the First National Bank. And perhaps I feel a little guilty, too, considering that Harry the Horse gives me the 7 happiest hours of my life. Because before I get on the A-train to go back up to Harlem 50 years ago, I call up Judge Goldfarber at his place out on the island, and I tell him the reason Harry the Horse and Spanish John and Little Isidore are late bringing the phone booth is because they are planning to double-cross him and keep it for themselves. Who Judge Goldfarber thinks I am and why I am calling him is anybody's guess, but I know he believes me. And furthermore, makes very good time in from the island, because I can remember back almost 50 years ago to when I am in the bleachers the day a real judge gives Judge Goldfarber the hot squat on account of his personal revolver matches up with the 6 slugs they dig out of Harry the Horse. The end.
Well, like a good watch, that lasted a lot longer than I expected it to. Let's get right to some music. Last podcast, I promised you a track by Ann Erthling and the Planets. Here's one now from her terrific CD, Planet Talk. and speaks a number of Earth's musical dialects, from reggae to grunge to jazz ballad, so it was hard to pick one, but you know why this title grabbed me, who spent 35 years married to the first free fall dancer. It's called Falling Free. Very nice. And does lead and backup vocals, guitars, and percussion. And now I'm going to have to spell out some of these names due to my own great ignorance. For example, I'm unfamiliar with the name I.S.E. and don't have a clue how to pronounce it. I.S.E. Bosch plays the living hell out of the bass on that song and sings backup. Hucky Portsner plays drums, no problem there. E-V-E-L-Y-N-E Dattle plays keyboards. Is that Evelyn, Eveline, Eveline, or Evelyn? I don't know. Colleen Allen and the Skits Chicks horns play on a few tracks, no problem. Maureen Brown sits in on drums a couple of times. And NYDIA, Nydia Nydia Liberty Mata is heard on percussion. If you'd like a copy of Planet Talk, send a check or money order for $15 U.S. made out to Anna, spelled A-N-A Perez. Send it to 7777 Bodega Avenue, apartment 204, Sebastopol, California, 95472. This next track is another major new discovery for me that I think you'll really like. The occasion is a memorial concert held in Salzö this July for the late great Swedish jazz pianist Esbjörn Svensson, whose stunning Esbjörn Svensson trio opened the door for a lot of Swedish jazz musicians to break out internationally. Esbjörn died 3 years ago at age 44 in a tragic scuba accident. This is one of his close friends, Nils Landgren, a trombonist with whom he recorded an almost shockingly beautiful album of trombone and piano called Layers of Light, which I highly recommend. The piano here is by Michael Volny, and the vocal and trombone solo are by Nils Landgren.
We may never pass this way again. So let me enjoy it till it's over. Just the echo of forever, lonesome as a love that might have been. So let me go on loving and believing till it's over. Please don't tell me how the story ends.
It has for me. Please Don't Tell Me How the Story Ends was written by Kris Kristofferson and was a country hit for Ronnie Milsap in the early 1970s. Now, for a complete change of pace, here's some head music by an astonishing composer named Joshua Penman. A few years ago, Jeannie and I were visiting the then studios of painter Alex Gray in Lower Manhattan, he's since moved, having our minds exploded by his viscerally gripping art, and Jeannie, with her infallible people radar, happened to see a guy and sensed that he had spiritual depths and went up and started a conversation. That was Joshua Penman, and mutual recognition signals were exchanged, and we all hit it off. It was one of those instant caress deals, and I've since downloaded a lot of the musical samples that Joshua makes available on his website, www.joshuapenman.com, but he has just released his first CD since we met, and it's mind-expanding. I've been playing it while I work on Orphan Stars, and it has been helping. Let me play you a track before I give you Joshua's CV. From his remarkable CD, Akara, Extra-Dimensional Ethnography, here is The Emperor and the Oracle for Ensemble.
Yeah.
See, to me, that's the musical equivalent of science fiction. You make up a new set of rules and see where they take you. At one point in there, you heard Joshua himself doing some rather good Tuvan throat singing, Siget style. We share an interest in Tuvan throat singing, and in previous podcasts, I've played you Seth Augustus adding several styles to his urban blues. As for Joshua's resume, it says here, Joshua Penman has written music for the films Caravan of Light, a spiritual art film, Deep Down, a feature documentary for PBS, In Destiny's Hands, a dramatic short, and The Human Machine, a documentary art film. He is currently writing the score for the feature coming-of-age comedy Sassy Pants, starring Ashley Rickards and Anna Gunn. He has also written music for Nimbus, an animated TV series in development, and commercials for Options Express and Embracing the World. He has signed on to provide scores for the feature horror film Lycanthropy, as well as the feature drama Walls of Jericho. He is producing additional music for the World War II supernatural thriller Panzer 88, directed by Peter Briggs of Hellboy and produced by Gary Kurtz of Star Wars. As a concert composer, Joshua has received commissions from, well, I'll just say an impressive list of symphonies. Additionally, his music has been performed by an even more lengthy and impressive list of symphonies. He has won awards for composition from ASCAP, BMI, Columbia, and Yale University. He received doctoral and master's degrees in composition from University of Michigan and a bachelor's degree in music and mathematics from Yale University. In addition, he has studied North Indian classical singing with Sri Devadish Day and Sundanese gamelan with Pak Nono S. He now lives in Los Angeles, where he is directing his creative energies toward film composition. If you go to http://akaraproject.com, you'll be able to hear more samples from that album, and then to either download the whole album instantly in literally any audio format you could possibly want, MP3, 320, FLAC, Ogg Vorbis if you wish, for only $9, or, here's the deal I went for, you can have a CD sent to you in a beautiful Digipak CD featuring original artwork by Andrew Jones and Zavi, and still download the album instantly while you wait for it to arrive in the mail, all for a mere 15 bobs. You cannot ask for a better deal than that unless you want I should pop yous. Now, here are a couple of gorgeous tracks I received as gifts from my friend Graham Nash recently. The first is him and David Crosby live in 1993, and the second is a recent demo of Graham's that is as strong as anything he's ever done, and I hope is a harbinger of a new solo album soon. But first, here's the most telepathic vocal duo since the Everly Brothers, David and Graham, singing Old Soldier.
Listen, old soldier, wherever you are, the hills or the valleys, come near or come far. They say youth's a treasure we waste when we're young, so come down from the place where your medals are hung. You're forever returning and learning to fight, and you feel just like an old soldier tonight. Listen, old soldier, 'cause time doesn't wait. Wounds on your shoulder, the hour is late. There's something there inside you, still calls out to you. And it won't fade away, whatever you do. You're forever beginning, barely winning the fight. You feel just like an old soldier tonight. You're not getting any younger, that much is true now. But you still got that hunger burning in you now. So What do you do now? Listen, old soldier, to the sound in your ears of too many battles for too many years. There's only one thing you've learned in defeat, is that losing is bitter and victory is sweet. You're always unraveling, traveling light, and you feel just like an old soldier tonight. You feel just like an old soldier tonight.
This next song is by Graham, and it's about a man named Bradley Manning. There are at least two important controversies regarding Bradley Manning, one being whether his admitted leaking of secret cables and the like to WikiLeaks was a moral act or black treason, and the other being whether the conditions of the solitary confinement he received as a result were appropriate and humane or sadistic. For what it's worth, in April 2011, 295 scholars, including legal scholars and philosophers, all signed a letter saying the conditions Manning experienced amounted to a violation of the U.S. Constitution. Later that month, the Pentagon transferred him to medium security at Leavenworth, allowing him to interact with other pretrial detainees. Here's Graham Nash's take.
Up in a white room, underneath a glaring light. Every 5 minutes, they're asking me if I'm alright. Locked up in a white room, making this the day I was born. 24 bright light, 24 all alone. What I did was show some truth to the world. Thank you. in a white room, dying to communicate, trying to hang in there underneath the crushing weight. Locked up in a white room, I'm always facing time. 24 bright lights, 24 down the line. What I did was show some
great stuff. By the way, I cannot possibly recommend highly enough Graham's two books of eye-expanding photography, Eye to Eye, which is all his own photos, and Taking Aim, which is truly great rock photos by others selected by Graham. Both had very special meaning for Jeannie and me, and I refer to them both often to this day. Thanks for coming by, folks. I hope you enjoyed the science fiction and the music. Thank you particularly for your very kind and generous donations, which have helped me to get to the writing by being able to occasionally throw money at some time-sink problem or other. By the next podcast, I will be fully past the whole cataract surgery thing with new glasses. It's all gone quite satisfactorily so far, and hopefully that will increase the flow of words, if not the quality of the typing. I'll see you next time. Speaking of donations, though, if you take nothing else away from this podcast, I hope you will race to your keyboard or other input device and score yourself at least a couple of CDs by one of my favorite vocalists and guitarists of all time, the great Moe Scarlett of Toronto, a student and friend of Lonnie Johnson himself. Moe's wife, Tina Cohen, is presently going through a major health crisis as serious as the one that claimed my Jeannie. And Moe has serious health issues of his own. I can tell you from my own experience that in such times, cash helps, and you couldn't possibly spend your music dollar more compassionately or more soundly. To demonstrate that latter clause, I'm going to let Moe play us all out with a couple of songs to his sweetie. The first is from his classic album, Precious Seconds, and the last is from the equally splendid, The Fundamental Things. Brother Moe's will now testify, and I'm out of here.
She used to dress in silken lace, drive a Rolls-Royce car. Now she looks quite out of place, like a fallen star. Draped around my kitchen sink, happy as can be. It just makes me stop and think why she fell for me. I'm not much to look at, nothing to see. Just glad I'm living and lucky to be. I got a woman crazy for me. She's funny that way. Can't save a dollar, ain't worth a cent. She doesn't holler, she'd live in a tent. I got a woman crazy for me. She's funny that way. And though she loves to work can slay for me every day. She'd be so much better off if I went away. But why should I leave her? How could I go? She'd be unhappy without me, I know. I got a woman crazy for me. She's funny that way. Unhappy without me, I know. I got a woman crazy for me. She's funny that way. Thank you. love songs never out of date. Hearts full of passion, jealousy and hate. Woman needs man, man must have his mate. That no one can deny. It's still the same old story, a fight for love and glory, a case of do or die. Welcome, lovers, as time goes by.
As time goes by,
the world will always welcome lovers as time goes by.